Hey, this is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is this week's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks so much for listening to this week's podcast for the week of August 12th. Let's take a look at some top stories. Farming often involves traveling long distances in remote areas to check on crops or cattle. And no matter what crop is being harvested, you'll often find many farmers share one thing in common, a farm dog. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports, working dogs may be a tool in the ongoing battle between cattle ranchers and the reintroduction of the Mexican gray wolf.
Before we get into the fiercely debated Mexican gray wolf topic, let's talk about dogs. I've visited countless farms for agriculture or rural-related stories. I always look forward to it, no matter how long the trip or how early the call time. In fact, the first feature story I did when I moved to the state in 2015 involved dogs.
So don't be surprised. This is okay. Not the only dog.
I love dogs, so that's totally fine.
Yeah, I read that.
Okay, this was not technically on a farm, but it was in rural Pima County. I also tend to write those dogs into the story, especially if they are particularly talkative. Most of the time, the farm dogs I meet are working, like on a fish farm east of Dateland. The big white dogs that may have been Great Pyrenees help to protect the goats that also live on the farm.
Hello.
At a half-day forum put on by the Arizona Department of Agriculture, I learned big white dogs are actually an umbrella of farm dog category, like Akbash or Anatolian Shepherd dogs. The forum was meant to educate ranchers in northeastern Arizona and New Mexico on how to use dogs to protect their herds. Wyoming sheep rancher and keynote speaker Kat Urbekite says American ranchers are behind their global counterparts in effectively using dogs.
We've only had used livestock guardian dogs in a systematic way in America for about the last 40 years, even though they've been used for thousands of years in other areas of the world.
That would be in countries like Spain and Turkey, where some of her dogs come from. Decades ago, government officials began working with American sheep herders to use dogs as flock protectors. She says cattle ranchers haven't had the same benefit.
But now the sheep industry in America has had 4 decades of experience in using livestock guardian dogs. So we have somewhat of a culture of using that now. But cattle producers, it's just never been targeted for them.
Since the reintroduction of the Mexican gray wolf in Arizona and New Mexico, cattle ranchers have had to deal with their herds being targeted by the intelligent predators. Urbekite says there is no such thing as a peaceful coexistence between a rancher and a native wolf.
Sometimes I cringe when I hear the coexistence thing because I heard someone say a peaceful coexistence, and I can tell you as a livestock producer who runs both sheep and cattle in wolf country, it is not a peaceful coexistence.
Her dogs work as herd protectors. They will fight a wolf, sometimes to the death. And though they are well-loved, they are not pets.
My guardian dogs, it's like having the best hired hand ever.
The forum was contentious at times. At one point, a man stood up to question a U.S. official who was presenting on how many investigations they'd done into livestock killed by the Mexican gray wolf. Arizona Department of Agriculture Director Mark Killian says he hoped the forum would give ranchers a tool to use in their work.
It's having a negative impact on the ranchers. They're losing lots of livestock. And so the purpose of this meeting was to give them some hope.
The federal government has indemnity payments for livestock producers who lose animals to wolves. Killian says his role in the state ag department is to help educate ranchers on what resources they have.
We don't have any money to do a wolf program, so everything we do on this, we just kind of cobble together. We borrow employees from different parts of the divisions to put a team together, and we work and we do a lot of work on our own.
Dog Forum attendee Teresa Trujillo says she started keeping Anatolian Shepherds in her home in the White Mountains when she thought of keeping some small farm animals.
I called our ag extension agent in Apache County, and his response was, "Oh, no, you don't want to do that there. There are too many predators." And I said, "Well, what if I bring an Anatolian Shepherd up with me?" He goes, "Oh, then we don't have to have this conversation."
Her dogs have grown in number, and she lives near a cattle ranch. She says while she doesn't have livestock, the nearby rancher says the dogs have helped his business.
And the cattleman who runs his cattle on that open range says that since we brought in the dogs, he hasn't lost any calves, and he used to lose 1 to 3 a year in that area.
Trujillo thinks it's about time American cattlemen start using farm dogs as tools against wolves, because the Mexican gray wolf is not going away anytime soon. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Apache County.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, which airs weekdays from 9 until 10. Here's one of the co-hosts, Lauren Gilger.
JCPenney is looking to rebuild its brand with secondhand fashion. The company announced the closure of dozens of stores earlier this year, but now it's partnering with online resale platform ThredUp in an attempt to bring a new energy and a new customer to the chain. And JCPenney isn't alone. High-end department store Neiman Marcus is getting into the secondhand luxury accessory business with online reseller Fashion File to try to capture a piece of the resale pie. But what these companies are just starting to explore today has been the backbone of at least one local name for nearly three decades. Anne Siner co-founded My Sister's Closet in 1991, and she now has 15 stores across Arizona and California selling women's and men's fashion, plus furniture and art. I spoke with her more about what it could mean for these big box stores to be getting into her business and how much the secondhand landscape has changed in the last three decades.
It was a complete novelty. It was 1991, and it was almost, in some cases, like shameful. Like, you know, don't let people know that I'm consigning with you or that I bought something used from you.
So the landscape has definitely shifted from then and is shifting now. What do you think has changed? Like, what, do you think it's an awareness of sort of the value in this, or like, is it a sustainability issue?
I think it's everything combined. I think, first of all, human nature is that we love to save money. And if we can save money on really quality items, who's not going to be happy with it? And I think probably the millennials have helped a little bit to admit that, you know what, I bought my entire outfit from, you know, a resale store and only paid $25 instead of $250.
And why do you think it is that just now sort of these big chains are starting to figure this out and say, you know, maybe we should get into the secondhand fashion business?
My personal opinion is that the GFC, the global financial crisis in 2008 to 2012, really hurt them. And at that point, you know, the savvy ones should have said, hey, look at what the resale business is doing. But it took them a few years because nobody wants to say used things are better than new things. But I think it's come to that. I think the other thing that happened is when we entered the market, one of the reasons I think for our success is we thought other resale stores were what we call the 3Ds, dark, dirty, dingy. You know, you had to siphon through, you know, all kinds of things, wire hangers to find something nice. And our goal was to make our store look like a brand new store. Hmm. You walk in, everything's really clean, current, cute, and it's dirt cheap.
So it's not just about the cost, though. You see a lot on social media now, and I know I hear a lot about this from friends and influencers, for lack of a better phrase, that there's a lot more awareness, I think, that the fashion industry is, you know, something that takes a lot of resources and sometimes uses bad labor practices. There's sort of a sustainability element here in terms of buying new things versus using something old. Is that a message you've always sent?
This is a message we've always sent, is recycle, reuse whenever you can. It's not just, you know, about the bad labor practices, but what goes into the landfill is just astounding. And it's not like it ever composts or, you know, goes away. It's leaching poisons into the environment constantly with the textiles.
And what could this mean for your business as you watch these major companies get on the bandwagon?
What I think happens to our business, and we're 28 years old now, and we're still having almost double-digit growth this year. Our growth is phenomenal. It's just that it's so much more accepted, and I think Marie Kondo in her, mm-hmm. you know, quest for cleaning things out was very helpful to our business and to the industry as a whole. And I think just the acceptability of it, and I think the retailers are catching on that this is the wave of the future, and they better hop on the bandwagon.
Well, you have to sort of adjust to account for some of these changes and maybe more awareness on one hand of secondhand and even a greater acceptability for it. But also, is this going to be competitive for you?
It is going to be competitive. And we've always said we're never going to rest on our laurels, that, you know, we want to always have the cleanest, most beautiful stores. So it will make us raise the bar and live to a higher standard.
How has your store had to change over the years in your approach? Like, as we've watched brick and mortar stores have more trouble and things move online, is that something that you've taken into account in the secondhand world?
Yes, it is. We our online presence is not a true online shopping where you put it in your cart, but rather, you know, the products are listed with detailed photographs, but you still have to call the store because in our mind, they're used. And I can tell you it's a fabulous Gucci bag, but it might have a slight pen mark on the inside. So we, you know, we want you to understand you're getting something used. What's interesting, though, is that we've stayed brick and mortar for 28 years and our growth is so strong. And I think people still like to come in, touch it, try it on, you know, look at the item before they buy it.
All right, that's Ann Siner, the founder of My Sister's Closet. Thank you for coming on. We appreciate the time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Now from the business desk, here's a look at Prop 105 with Christina Estes from KJZZ.
Groups for and against light rail in Phoenix are pushing their messages extra hard. Early voting is already underway for an August 27th election that could mark the end of the line or signal a green light to build more. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me now to fact check some of the arguments for and against. So Christina, let's quickly recap what led to this election.
Well, this started with some residents and business owners in South Phoenix who didn't want to see Central Avenue reduced from 4 lanes to 2 lanes to make room for light rail. It has since morphed into a full anti-light rail initiative. If voters approve Prop 105, it will stop the South Central extension, as well as other future light rail projects.
I mean, arguably the biggest complaint among light rail opponents is that it's simply costs too much. And isn't it true that the cost for the South Central extension has in fact doubled?
Can I answer this one yes and no? Technically, the project cost has increased from an estimated $700 million to more than $1.3 billion.
Clearly, there is more to this answer.
There is. One of the reasons is higher construction costs, both labor and materials. But the bigger reason is the addition of what's called the downtown hub.
What is the hub then?
It would be a centralized transfer station. The 5.5-mile extension from downtown to South Phoenix is one project. The city's also working on a 2-mile extension west of downtown to the state capitol complex. So city staffers said rather than look at them as two separate projects, let's look at the big picture.
And what did they see?
They think having one hub where people can transfer and take trains in different directions will be more efficient for users. Building a downtown hub will add roughly $300 million to the total cost. In addition to that, Valley Metro CEO Scott Smith told the Arizona Republic the federal government has decreased its share of funding. In 2017, Phoenix expected the federal government to cover about 58% of the total cost, and now it's more like 47%.
Okay. Another argument from light rail opponents is that the money could be spent on roads and sidewalks. Is that accurate?
Some of the money planned for light rail could go to other transportation projects if approved by the city council. Here's how the funding breaks down for the South Central extension, which includes that new downtown hub. 32% comes from a transit sales tax approved by Phoenix voters. That's the money that could go to other projects if the council approved. The next funding source is the regional sales tax that covers transportation projects. It makes up 21% of funding and can only be used for rail.
Okay, so if the math is correct, then that does leave that 47%, which you said comes from the federal government.
That's right, and that 47% can only be used for the South Central extension. Supporters of light rail like to say, hey, we would lose hundreds of millions in funds if you vote to end light rail, while opponents say, well, you can't really lose what you never get.
So the city's share, 32%, still a real sizable amount. That's around $400 million.
Right. And we've talked before about the condition of Phoenix roads. It's one of the top complaints council members get. The Street Transportation Department found 70% of Phoenix streets are considered fair, poor, or very poor.
And you've already reported on the council approving $450 million for an accelerated pavement maintenance program.
Yeah, and that's another point the pro-light railers like to bring up. They like to say, hey, the city is addressing streets. On the flip side, the anti-light railers point out the Street Transportation Department said to get all Phoenix streets in good condition would cost $1.6 billion. It is also important to mention that that 2015 voter-approved transit sales tax is designed to not only help fund light rail, but also street repairs and bus service.
Okay, that brings us to another argument among light rail opponents, that more people drive and ride the bus than use light rail. Opponents say it's a huge expense to serve a small number of people. In Phoenix, light rail attracts about 50,000 riders each weekday. What did you find looking at the numbers?
Valley Metro's most recent performance report covers fiscal year 2017 to 18. Before I get to the numbers, keep in mind, every time a person steps inside a bus or a light rail car, that counts as one boarding. For example, last week I took the train and I counted as two boardings because I got on one car heading one way and switched cars to return.
So clearly there was a celebrity sighting on the light rail, but let's go back to how the round trip equals two boardings. Okay, so we have that. So what's the report show?
For the year, bus boardings increased more than a million to 51 million, while light rail boardings decreased roughly half a million to just under 16 million.
And then what about operating costs?
Well, there are a few ways operating costs are broken out. I like to look at what's called operating subsidy per boarding. So that's how much it costs to operate after subtracting fares. And we should note that public transportation is subsidized in every city. Exactly how much can vary.
And what did you find?
For buses, the operating subsidy per boarding is $4.64. So that's how much public money is needed to cover the cost associated with one bus rider. For light rail, it's $1.97. In both cases, operating subsidies have increased significantly since 2016, about 60 cents for rail and almost a dollar for the bus.
And that is KJZZ's Christina Estes. Thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on the show, Christina will tell us about a longtime Phoenix resident who lives near the light rail line and is unsure about which way to vote.
With early voting underway for the August 27th election that will decide whether to cancel future light rail extensions in Phoenix, we've been taking a closer look this week at arguments both for and against the transportation system. And for that, we're joined now by KJZZ's Christina Estes. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so yesterday you broke down funding sources, ridership figures, and operating costs for us. And today you want to dive into one figure in particular here. So what's that?
It's $11 billion. That's the amount light rail supporters use as a measure of success. In its economic development brochure, Valley Metro says $11 billion in public and private investment has been made along the line since 2005. And it's important to note that light rail did not open until December 2008.
So why are projects included 3 years before the line opened?
Well, because certain people knew it was coming. For example, developers were talking about light rail before it opened because they knew the city was using eminent domain to buy private property. And contractors started working pretty quickly after the funding agreement was signed in 2005.
Okay, so you got a hold of Valley Metro's database of development projects that it attributes to light rail. What'd you find?
The database includes 344 projects Valley Metro says are located within a half a mile of a light rail line. The projects are either currently under construction or completed going back to 2005, with the exception of one project. It dates back to 2002. That was 3 years before construction started.
What's that one?
It's the first phase of Hayden Ferry Lakeside in Tempe. Today, it's this big mixed-use development along Tempe Town Lake, but its first building opened in 2002 and accounts for more than $21 million in Valley Metro's database. There are also several projects that someone could argue would have happened anyway without light rail.
Like what?
In 2005 and 2006 in Tempe, two buildings went up as part of ASU's Biodesign Institute. Those buildings add up to $150 million in Valley Metro's database. There's also the Phoenix Art Museum's expansion completed in 2006. That appears in the database as an $18 million redevelopment project.
Well, okay, so what's the biggest item in this database?
The $600 million expansion of the Phoenix Convention Center. It started in the early 2000s and wrapped up just in time for light rail's opening in 2008. Supporters say light rail was a critical part of downtown's transformation, and it'll be good for other areas too. Of course, not everyone buys that.
Right. We've heard concerns from people in South Phoenix, especially about construction hurting small businesses there.
And there's no doubt some businesses will not survive. We have seen that happen. I can tell you the city and Valley Metro have set aside additional money to support South Phoenix businesses during construction through marketing and advertising services and offering low interest loans.
What about concerns the light rail will bring more crime to neighborhoods? We hear that a lot as well.
Yep, that's also something that we've heard in areas that have light rail. For example, along 19th Avenue, residents have complained a lot about inappropriate and illegal behavior on the trains and platforms. About 2 years ago, we reported on a large increase in calls to police along 19th Avenue. Trespassing, shoplifting, thefts were among the most common calls.
Okay, and refresh our memory. How did Phoenix Police and Valley Metro respond to all of that?
Well, police increased patrols, and then Valley Metro added more private security officers. And I noticed those security officers when I rode light rail just last week.
What was it like?
It was like riding public transportation. It's mass transit, so it's open to everyone. I saw great diversity. And not just race and ethnicity, but also people who use wheelchairs and people who carried their bicycles on.
What route did you take?
I got on at 19th Avenue and Dunlap, rode through downtown to 38th Street and Washington.
So the train picked up and dropped off a lot of people along the way, I'm sure.
Yeah, and most people were quiet and sort of in their own world. But there was also the guy talking really loudly on his phone, another guy who sat next to me with really strong cologne. Again, it's public transit, so you have variety.
Okay, so let's move on to your conversation with a longtime Phoenix resident who lives near the 19th Avenue light rail line. Did she tell you how she's planning to vote?
When we talked late last week, she was still torn. I didn't record the conversation, and I'm not using her name because she's been active in the community for a really long time. She works with the city on neighborhood projects and doesn't want to risk hurting those relationships.
Got it. So why is she torn about the future of this light rail extension?
In her view, light rail has not been a positive experience for her neighborhood. So in one sense, she wants to vote for Prop 105, which would end future projects. On the other hand, she says she doesn't want her area to be the end of the line because she worries it'll create a dead-end environment.
But 19th Avenue has seen improvements since the 3-mile extension opened 3 years ago, right?
It has. Some well-known restaurant chains have opened, and some of the established neighborhoods around 15th Avenue and 21st Avenue are seeing more market-rate housing being built. But that's not enough to convince a resident I talked to last night after he filled out his ballot.
Okay, how did he vote?
He voted for Prop 105.
And why? Why? What was his reasoning?
Well, for one, he says it's inconvenient for most people to use. Over the weekend, he said he was going to take it from 19th Ave in Phoenix to Washington Street and Mill Avenue in Tempe. Going one way, he said the train would have stopped 21 times and taken 52 minutes, so he just ended up driving. He also thinks construction takes too long and it's too disruptive. He thinks express buses are a cheaper, faster alternative.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard light rail opponents argue that changing technology could mean fewer people use light rail in the future. What does Valley Metro say about that?
A spokesperson told me in the future, Valley Metro will continue to advance a network of transportation options, including rideshare and autonomous vehicles, to support quick growth and limited real estate. She said high-capacity transit is and will be the most effective way to move large numbers of people in finite spaces.
All right. And that's KJZZ's Christina Estes filling us in on all of the debate around Prop 105 and the future of the light rail here. Christina, thank you.
You're welcome.
And in education news, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
Many students are back in the classroom as a new school year kicks off, and their teachers have likely been busy ahead of their return. For many teachers, that might mean they've spent their own money on a variety of classroom items that their schools and districts did not or would not provide. Hundreds of teachers have shared their tabs on social media, some reporting hundreds, even thousands of dollars spent so far this year. Rebecca Gorelli is a sixth grade science teacher in Phoenix and one of the leaders behind last year's Red for Ed movement, and she joins us now to talk about the sometimes pricey preparations. Rebecca, good morning. Are you seeing any noticeable difference in the classroom that indicates that actually more money has been committed there?
Absolutely not. The only actual dollars we've seen have come in small increases in paychecks. Not one teacher I've spoken to or heard on Facebook through, we've been doing a little bit of surveying on our Facebook pages and listening to comments from people, is that the money is not trickling down to the classroom, the actual needs of the classroom for supplies, infrastructure. We haven't seen that yet, but the only monies we have seen are directly related to increases, very small increases in salary.
What does that say to you then about what's going on?
It says that we're not prioritizing the actual needs of the classroom. We're not prioritizing the needs of the teachers or the students. Class size is still enormously large. I put a Facebook post asking people, what's your class size this year? Where are you standing as we speak at the beginning of the year? And we're looking at 30 plus in many classes, even down to kindergarten, which is very disheartening because we need additional funding to decrease the size and really increase student achievement. And it's just disheartening.
Teachers have already had to spend out of their own pockets when it comes to their classrooms to try to help their students, whether it's to create a more comfortable learning environment, that sort of thing. What are teachers having to prioritize in terms of spending like that?
So we actually, you know, surveyed people a little bit ago asking, you know, how much did you spend in your classroom and what was that spending actually spent on, what materials? And so we had people anywhere from basic necessities of notebooks and pencils and glue to I need furniture, I don't have any shelving. And the shelving I do have is actually, you know, falling apart and crumbling. So I'm just going to go and purchase something or go to Goodwill on my own accord. I just think there's a spectrum of where people are spending their dollars, anywhere from $50 all the way up to over $1,000. And it's a combination of basic necessities just to engage students in the learning process through all the way to, you know, decorating their classroom to make a more, you know, welcoming and inviting space for their students.
As we said, you are an educator in Phoenix, and at least your specialty, I will say, is science. And I wanted to ask you just one specific question about that, because when we're looking at science standards changing, and I know that in the past you've talked about having to use expired chemicals and whatnot for science labs, is there a bigger concern that that disparity is going to get even greater as the standards may have expectations that are going to cause certain things to fall even further behind because you don't have the material you need?
I'm really glad you asked that question. We have both new science and social studies standards. And so for educators to implement those instructional shifts and be successful in doing so, yes, that's going to require new resources. Yes, that may require new materials. We definitely can pull from our old resources, but I definitely think there's a correlation between having new standards and then not directly purchasing new curriculum, which obviously is, you know, we're a local control state. The ability to purchase materials comes through districts. But in general, yes, I would say that new science standards, new social studies standards are going to mean that educators are going to be spending more out of their pockets because they want to implement those standards in the appropriate, best way for their students.
As we look ahead to 2020, the legislative session, certainly the Red for Ed movement has made a huge impact here in Arizona. And I wonder going forward, how much do you expect there to have to be an effort? It doesn't have to necessarily be more candidates, though that may be the case, who have education backgrounds, but even just having to keep a closer eye on what the legislature is doing, what the governor is doing. How active do you expect the movement to be?
I anticipate the movement to be incredibly active. I think people have now had their eyes open to, you know, the legislative process, how it works, where funding comes from. I think we've done a really great job educating our members about the legislative process and really trying to plug people into the process so they understand it and then can figure out the best way that they want to spend their time. Where do they want to be active? Do they want to be active in a legislative district? Do they want to spend time going to their local governing, you know, school boards, that kind of thing? So I think, you know, it's going to vary. I think some districts are going to be heavily going to governing board meetings. I think other districts might want to pour their time into legislative districts that can be flipped. I mean, I think it's all going to depend on where you are and what, you know, what your commitment is to the movement. But I'm going to say overall, I think we're very dedicated to continuing this work moving forward.
Is it possible to maintain that kind of momentum?
You know, in any movement, I think we have, you know, sort of a roller coaster pattern where we have, you know, strength in numbers and coming out in full force to, you know, slowing down and taking a step back. And so I think we're going to see movement in different ways. I think, you know, different issues will motivate and mobilize different groups. And over time, I'd say that we're moving forward no matter what. But the amount of energy is definitely going to vary depending on the issues and the locals.
All right. That is Rebecca Gorelli. She is a Phoenix-based educator. Rebecca, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Next, Fronteras News. Fronteras literally translates to borders, and the Fronteras desk brings you stories from the southern border with Mexico and beyond, and the northern borders with Native American nations. Millions of people have been killed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo since the 1990s. Millions more fled their homes. Now Congolese are the fastest-growing refugee population in Arizona. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Matthew Casey reports that tension born almost 9,000 miles away is still felt by those who escaped the deadliest conflict since World War II.
The new president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo took office in January. Al Jazeera reported that his first message was one of reconciliation in the vast and diverse African country. Refugees living in Phoenix say the new president was more specific in June, calling for an end to conflict in parts of eastern Congo. The area is home to people named Banyamulenge. They're an ethnic minority with Rwandan ancestry. Rugabira Ruhorimberi is one of them. He was once jailed by the Congolese government and nearly executed.
Hopefully, this issue can be resolved.
The Banyamulenge community in Phoenix went to state officials, Republican and Democrat, to seek U.S. help in making sure the new president keeps his word. Ruhorimberi says Banyamulenge want the government to defeat all armed militias in eastern Congo.
Protect everyone, all people, from all tribes.
The civic action by Banyamulenge in Phoenix did not sit well with other Congolese in Arizona. They want pressure put on all countries involved in the conflict, not just the Congolese government. The disagreement is a window to the immensely complex situation in eastern Congo, which has come up in Phoenix. With a police escort, about 50 Congolese protesters marched toward the Arizona capital almost 2 weeks ago. The protesters gathered at the flagpoles near the House and Senate, and Lumumba Onakoi read a memo responding to Banyamulenge action.
We are here to advocate and durable and sustainable peace.
Onakoi says Congo has a long record of welcoming refugees from other countries like Rwanda, where millions fled in the 1990s. Onakoi said it hurt to see people turning against the country that took them in.
And massacre our population, rape our mothers, sisters, and daughters.
Onakoi laid out 8 requests. One was for refugee resettlement groups to stop giving Congolese nationality to people without official government documentation.
We have seen many people from other countries who come to the United States as a Congolese by just living in the some of those camps.
Questions about nationality were repeatedly used by Congolese politicians to target Banyamulenge in the past. The government once even ordered Banyamulenge to go back to Rwanda, writes Severin Otisser, a professor, author, and researcher who works regularly in Congo.
It's as if someone was telling you, go back to Europe or go back to Ireland or wherever your ancestor came from 200 years ago. It makes no sense.
Otisser writes that Rwandan Tutsis came to Congo in waves before and during Belgian colonization. They later renamed themselves to distinguish from more recent arrivals. But people with Rwandan ancestry, especially Tutsis, were blamed for war in the 1990s. Ethnic violence raged in Congo. Otisser says Banyamulenge have been both targets and perpetrators.
Banyamulenge leaders have been responsible for atrocities, just like leaders from other ethnic groups have been responsible for atrocities.
Otisser says tension among Congolese refugees forced to flee home is common. She's also seen it in Belgium, New York, and Washington, D.C. Otisser thinks there is blame on both sides.
Given all of this history and given all of these antagonisms and all of these really, really hard memories for all of the people in Congo, how can they move forward so that they can live in peace?
Peace is something both local groups say they want for Congo. On the Banyamulenge side, Ruhore Mberi says Congolese living here should get to know each other.
Let's meet. I would love to do that. Let's meet. Let's talk.
One protest leader says he's willing to meet with Banyamulenge in Phoenix. Another says she needs to talk it over with her constituents first. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And last but not least, news from the Science Desk. Announced changes to the Endangered Species Act are expected to go into effect next month. The modifications will be prospective and apply to species that would be new additions to the endangered list. Environmental groups are concerned about the changes, but some observers say the impact is most likely to be incremental. One of those is attorney Paul Weiland, who is a former deputy U.S. attorney in the Law and Policy Section, Environmental and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice. KJZZ Steve Goldstein spoke with him about it and asked about frustrations some landowners have had with the ESA.
So the Endangered Species Act, among federal environmental laws, has been referred to as the pit bull historically, and that's principally because it has in it a set of prohibitions on activities that could kill or harm or harass protected species. And the process of deciding whether to protect a species explicitly cannot take into account societal or economic consequences. And so in contrast to many other federal environmental laws like the Clean Air Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act, where costs and benefits are actually purposefully balanced, the Endangered Species Act takes that balancing out of the equation. And so that leads to circumstances where there's more friction between societal concerns and protection of species. So over time, different administrations have tried to be more or less flexible about their implementation of the act to try and balance those societal concerns with endangered species protection. And I think what we're seeing is some of the ebb and flow of that which isn't always partisan. Frankly, the Clinton administration was probably the most progressive in terms of trying to actually balance the needs of landowners and government agencies with endangered species and seeking kind of win-win solutions versus being more of a hard-nosed set of regulators about how the act is implemented.
How significant could this change be then in thinking about the economic impact of protecting a certain species? That seems fairly significant to a lot of people.
I think that actually the set of regulatory changes that have been proposed are more incremental than revolutionary in this particular circumstance. And the economic factors is a good example. So it was Congress that decided that when you decide whether to list a species and protect it, that it's not, it's forbidden for the agencies to consider the economic consequences of their listing decision. And so only Congress can change that. And actually, in the final regulation, the Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service acknowledge that fact. And unfortunately, some of the reporting has suggested that they are going to be injecting economic considerations into the process. What they have done is they've said that they can report on the economic consequences of a listing decision. So that can be part of the disclosure that they make in their public documents when they decide to list the species, but they can't consider it in deciding whether to list the species. And that distinction is pretty important, even though it may seem pretty nuanced.
Was there a general feeling that certain aspects of the Endangered Species Act need to be updated periodically? And was this one of those times generally?
I think that, yeah, across a broad spectrum of kind of practitioners who work with the act, there is agreement that it needs to be updated. But the rub is that different people think different aspects need to be updated. So there are some areas where there's some commonality, actually. And some of the changes that were made, I think, are changes that there would be a common agreement on that. For example, there are a number of places in the regulations where the administration adds language that their decisions should be based on the best available scientific information, which is a phrase that's used in the statute as well. And I think whether you're, you know, for or against kind of the act or whether it's overly protective, most people would agree that if we're using science to guide us, that's a good thing. So some of those changes, I think, are the kind of changes a lot of people can get behind. Others, there's going to be some controversy involved with them because they make it more difficult to conduct other activities other than conserving species, or because they make it less difficult. And whenever that happens, you're going to have the folks on the regulated side of the equation or the folks on the species side of the equation kind of crying foul.
Okay. So these new guidelines generally were proposed at least a year ago, maybe a little bit more than that, and they're scheduled to take effect sometime next month. Any thoughts on how soon we'll start to see the effects of that?
Yeah, so one important thing to note about them is that the guidelines are, by and large, almost entirely prospective. So what that means is that any species that's already protected under the act will continue to be protected. Any area that's been designated as quote-unquote critical habitat under the act will continue to be critical habitat for the particular species at issue. So the impacts are going to be felt kind of gradually over time. And as I said earlier, I think they're incremental. And so I don't think we're going to see the type of kind of wave of impacts that some are concerned about here. What we will see is that with some species, for example, if there is a new petition to list a species, and there are some questions about whether it may at some point in the future be endangered, but right now it looks pretty healthy, that may be a circumstance where under the new rules, the administration will be less apt to list the species and protect the species as compared to how it would have handled it under the prior rules.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.